1042. It's Luke chapter 10, verse 38 to 42 that we're looking at this morning. Well, why don't we begin with verse 42? The words of Jesus given to Martha, the sister of Mary. Here he says, "But only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her." I suppose it is the fact that this church of all souls, for historical reasons, has its rector appointed by the Queen, that caused my wife and me to be on the invitation list for an evening reception some years ago at number 10 Downing Street. I've never said it publicly before, but it occurs to me that that did happen. Glancing around the guests that evening as we were assembled in the lobby, waiting to be introduced to the Prime Minister and her husband, we could pick out various notables around us. We were rubbing shoulders with them, really. Sports personalities, cabinet ministers, people whose faces were familiar on the media. Finally, we were each ushered into the presence of the Prime Minister, who shouted announcements and with a bit of a flourish. And the evening proceeded. If you were to ask me, who did you meet? What did they say? What did the Prime Minister say? I would be able to give you a reasonable impression, even after the passing of these years. If you were to ask me, what did you eat and drink? What did you have? I don't think I could tell you anything at all. I have no recollection of the food whatsoever, though I must pay tribute to those who prepared the food by saying that everything was fine. I would have remembered if the food was rancid or the coffee disgusting. But no, always in keeping with the nature of an evening event at number 10 Downing Street. Imagine that you had recently moved into Bethany, a small village about 2 miles distant from Jerusalem, in about the year 100 AD, and that you'd got talking with your new neighbor, one of Bethany's long-established senior citizens. And pointing at the house across the road, he reminisces to you, "I once spoke to Judas Iscariot in that house." You say, "Not the Judas." "Oh yes. They were all there that day, actually. All 12 of them." "What? You met with the 12 apostles?" "Yes. And Jesus too." "Jesus? You don't mean Jesus Christ?" "I do." "You met with the 12 apostles and with Jesus Christ in that house?" "I did." At that point, see, your brain would have been teeming with questions. But I doubt in 100 AD that any of those questions would be concerned with the nature of the food that day. The food had been part of all that made it a great and memorable occasion. But the occasion was Jesus and the 12 disciples visiting the home of Lazarus and his sisters Mary and Martha. Unforgettable. It's funny, you know, you've only got to mention Mary and Martha, and if you know your Bible at all or you've done your Sunday school stories, immediately people divide into two camps. Right away. The Martha camp, the practical ones, wear the roll up your sleeves kind of people, who tend to get irritated with the Marys of this world, the otherworldly, unfeeling visionaries. And as for the Marys, they just don't care. Does it matter which camp you're in? Do you even have to align yourself with a camp? Of course, we can immediately sympathize with Martha's situation. 13 hungry men descend upon you. No doubt with others from Bethany who drift in to see the celebrated guest of honor. You're in the kitchen alone, and it's up to you. True, Mary had been in already, I think, to do some of the helping. That seems to be implied in the Greek New Testament, where the word also is used. It's not here in the
New International Version, but the word also is used. So Martha is doing the food, and it says in the Greek New Testament that she had a sister called Mary, who also sat at Jesus' feet. Also sat, in addition, it seems, to having done some of the food herself. That's the implication of the Greek. But by the time the passage here in Luke 10:38 picks it up, Mary is rapt in attention. Jesus is speaking. Such words. Have there ever been the like of them? She couldn't move a muscle. She's just anchored there at Jesus' feet, listening. At that point, Martha really is alone in the kitchen. And at that point, Jesus' visit has ceased to be a pleasure and has become an irritation. There's only one point that this little episode makes for us here in Luke 10. Summed up in Christ's words, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen that good portion, that good part. Again, I'm looking at the Greek. The word is ambiguous. She's chosen the good part, the good portion. And that word could refer to a course of a meal. So I'm told in the Greek lexicon. And if Jesus is correcting Martha, then I don't think he's really scolding her, because he loved her too much. What he is doing, I think he is remonstrating with her in a playful way, maybe, as would be expected of somebody who loved to visit the home at Bethany. So basically, I think what he's saying is, oh, Martha, all these dishes. But let's not remove Mary from the dish of the day. What is the dish of the day? Right here. Don't take her away from that. It's something like that. One thing is needed, one portion, one dish. Let's try and understand the point that is being made. First, we are to present ourselves ultimately not as workers, but as disciples. Jesus is traveling with his friends, teaching, preaching, healing, encouraging, right on to glory. And who is going to respond to his saving mission to earth? Not for the food or the material benefits that he might bring them, but in a spirit of loving, obedient discipleship at this critical period for the salvation of the whole world. He's looking for followers, for disciples. Every time he came to a fresh town or village, it was a crisis. Now he's in Bethany. It's a tiny place. Still is. I've been there once. Very, very small. There is Jesus sitting in the house, and he's speaking. For some, it's a never-to-be-repeated opportunity. Mary, why, she's left the kitchen, she's left Martha there, and she's now sitting down with the others. Surely, Martha will be here in a tick. She ought to be. She mustn't miss more than just a bit of that wonderful talk. Words that summon people universally to the highest allegiance of all. He's speaking in the house now. But no, crash, clatter can be heard from the kitchen. It contrasts strangely with the entrancing words there in the front room. Come on, Martha. We only need a bite, maybe just a bit of brie. That'll be enough. Another clatter from the kitchen. Martha was a great worker. She's referred to elsewhere as having served the dishes. But actually, if we are to be a really effective worker, ladies and gentlemen, girls and boys, our work has to come as the overspill from our reservoir of love and inner discipleship. If anyone here aspires to be a Martha, then this passage is saying, to be an effective Martha, you've got to be a Mary. Without that aspect of wanting to spend time with Jesus, your involvement with Jesus will prove to be a burden, not a pleasure. So there's a bit of a warning here. If we think more of serving Christ than pleasing him, then our very Christian service will get in the way of our walk with God. Our service just must not be a substitute for the thing that really pleases Christ, spending time with him. It's a very simple point to make. We present ourselves not primarily as workers, but as disciples, as lovers. Søren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher of old, once said, "A believer is surely a lover, yea, of all lovers, the most in love." And so when we begin to find that we're resenting the service that we give in the service of Jesus Christ, there's always a reason. And let's look at it now. First, then, we present ourselves not as workers, but as disciples. Now, secondly, we focus ourselves not on many things, but on the one thing. Look again at Luke 10, verse 40. Shall I read there? Have a look. Keep your eyes on the page. "But Martha was distracted." That's a good translation. "But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. She came to Jesus and asked, 'Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me.' 'Martha, Martha,' the Lord answered, 'you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her.'" She's got the best dish, the dish of the day. We focus ourselves not on many things, but on the one thing. The one thing. Somehow Mary was doing what Martha found, and I think what I find, difficult. Concentrating her mind, focusing everything on a single point, and that point was Christ and his life-changing words. By contrast, there was a turbulence in Martha. So much to do, putting all those courses together, the eggs, the sauce, the vegetables, the salad, oh, where's the mayonnaise? All the rest of it. Now, we mustn't be sexist in the thought that women make such good cooks, because, of course, we've got a super chef downstairs right now making lunch for you all, and he's a very obviously male Australian. And he can hear the words I'm saying because he's got the PA switched on as well, I expect. Even so, I do marvel at the ability of cooks, and I suppose I've seen more women cooking than men, to be able to manage with so many different things happening at once. And on the whole, men like myself, well, I've repeatedly said to the people in the office when I start feeling a bit too many things coming at me, I say, a man can only do one thing at a time. So if I'm making scrambled egg, it's only by a superhuman effort that I can keep one eye on the toast at the same time. It wasn't exactly with Martha that she shouldn't have been keeping an eye on six different things all happening simultaneously as she prepared the meal. It was rather that she was distracted from the main business of the day, to make the visit of Jesus really worthwhile and to please him. Somehow the getting of the meal, it took over in priority, and it dominated all her thoughts. I've got to get this thing done. "Don't you care?" she remonstrated with Jesus. Remember, that's what the disciples themselves said when they saw Jesus at the back of the boat, asleep, during the great storm on Lake Galilee. "Wake him up. Don't you care? Look what's happening." Well, on that occasion, they too were distracted by the noise, the spray. They could only see the waves. That's all they could see. They'd lost sight of the fact that they were companions with Jesus Christ, Master of the world, Lord of the elements. And if we can't see the priority of spending time with Jesus Christ, we will become preoccupied. I do become preoccupied with a myriad of worries. Worries about health, about security, education, the family, money, the future. Those things will then dominate and crowd in and become number one. We're to focus every day not on those many things, but on the one thing. And then the many things will find their right place in the order of things. How do you focus? I think one of my best illustrations is from the world of sport. Younger ones here may not remember, 1975, the Wimbledon men's final, Arthur Ashe and Jimmy Connors. It was a memorable match. I watched every stroke of it. Connors was the red-hot favorite, easily. Ashe was supposedly past his best, a black player from America, deeply respected. And in fact, in the knock-up before, outside, when they were practicing, Connors, who was practicing with Ilya Stasi, they were having a great time clowning. Just clowning, playing around, because they knew who was going to win. Ashe, meanwhile, was sitting in deep, deep thought with his eyes closed as he got ready for the match. He was focusing. And when the match began, first set 6-1 to Ashe. And he was feeding Jimmy Connors with rubbish. Just little dink shots, little things that floated, nothing to hit at. Second set to Ashe, 6-1. Third set to Connors, and then the fourth set, Ashe polished off Connors and won the match. They called it the cerebral match of the 70s, because it was all done in the head. Ashe had thought out his tactics, and he completely outthought his opponent. He died, as you probably know, just a few months ago from AIDS, which he most sadly contracted from faulty blood transfusion. He died, I'm informed on the highest authority, as a firmly believing Christian, knowing Christ as his Lord. That's my illustration. And I remember seeing Ashe at the changeover in between games, sitting there at the umpire's chair, turned away from Connors, focusing, eyes closed, just focusing, thinking it out, focusing. It looked as though nothing was happening, but everything was happening while he was focusing. It's an illustration from the world of sport of what we may do every day, focusing. The Bible is going to help. Prayer is going to help. To help us to step into each day, each week, each challenge. A friend of mine on the staff was quoting to me John Chapman, who has ministered in this church before, from Australia. And John Chapman will say at the beginning of the day, the paper, then there's the cricket, he could be switching on the television, then he could be getting a cup of coffee, then there's the unopened mail. And he said, until I get to prayer and the Bible, I've been losing. After that, he says, I'm winning. The one thing, my life, in and with Jesus Christ, getting to know him better, listening to his words, allowing my life and my attitude to be shaped by him, focusing. It's not wasted time. It's not passive time. Look at Mary, sitting there in the home of Bethany. Can you see her in your mind's eye? Sitting there. She's not doing much, is she? Mary, haven't you got time for anything else? Get up the knitting. You a good knitter? Would like to just do a few things in the house. Go to the door. Check out what's happening in the kitchen. She's not doing anything. She's just sitting, doing nothing. And yet everything is happening there in her as she listens to the life-changing words of Jesus Christ. Take a modern example of a woman who used to be a member of this church, then moved away. I occasionally get letters from her. Lillian Walsh is her name. Some of the old stages here will remember her. She described how she came to this church as absolutely in a fog, not understanding a thing about a relationship with Christ. And before she ever heard of All Souls, she said she bought herself a Bible in despair and went on holiday. Nowhere very pretentious, she went to Bournemouth. This is what she later wrote in a book that was then published and is called My Hand in His. I packed my suitcase and went to Bournemouth. I took the Bible with me. The sun shone brilliantly all the time I was there, and I had the most extraordinary holiday that I have ever had in my life. I did not go to any place of entertainment. I did not do anything that one usually does on holiday. I merely read the Bible and sat in the sun. And yet I was happier than I had ever been before. When somebody at the hotel suggested going to the cinema one evening, I shrank from the thought. All I wanted to do was to read the Bible and to sit and think about what I had read. So she just sat and read out there in the front. Nothing was happening, apparently, but everything was happening. She goes on to say, in a tiny shop in Boscombe, I discovered some texts beautifully inscribed on parchment paper. I bought John 14:6 and Matthew 11:28. And directly I got home from my holidays, I stuck the text on the walls of my room. I was now almost sick with longing to go to church and to belong somewhere. Next week, I will go to evening service, I thought. I did. It was a, quote, guest service. I did not know what that meant. That evening, in the guest service, she encountered Christ. It began with the Bible, focusing, reading, sitting, with apparently nothing happening, but everything was happening. Well, I had a letter from Lillian Walsh only a few months ago. One thing I do, wrote Paul in Philippians chapter 3, verse 13, I press on towards the goal to win the prize. And then he tells us in the same passage what the prize is, verse 10, I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his suffering. You can be doing many things in life. Indeed, we are required to. But what is the one thing for which we're living? Ask yourself that on this Sunday. The one dominating, driving force that gives unity, integration for the whole of life. Because until we are fastened onto that one thing that Mary had found in attending to Christ and his words, we will invariably miss the point of life and the direction of life. So, we present ourselves not as workers, but as disciples. We focus ourselves not on many things, but on the one thing. We have time for our last observation. Thirdly, we model ourselves not on each other, but on Christ. That's vital. It's no good looking over our shoulder at others and saying, if only I was like them. Or even, if only they were like me. Sometimes people do it within the partnership of marriage, trying to reform each other to be more like themselves. It always results in unnecessary tension. No, if there's any reforming to be done, let it be God who reforms both partners in marriage to be more like his Son, Jesus Christ, in character and outlook. But personality-wise, we're all made different. We model ourselves then not on each other, but on Christ. We're not told to be imitators of either Martha or Mary or of anyone else, but of Jesus Christ. And then just look at Jesus. Look at him for a moment. From your memory of what you read in the Bible about him, Jesus, was there ever such a busy person as Jesus Christ? Activity, service, are just stamped all over his whole style. And yet, was there ever such a tranquil and prayerfully receptive disposition as he displayed? He could take himself apart to be with the Father in prayer. Everything was focused, controlled, directed in the greatest model of living ever set before the human race. He's our model. We must not model ourselves on each other. We're responsible to Christ, our leader. Otherwise, we shall find that a competitive spirit creeps into our Christian service and living. And then we start to say, I'm busier than them, or I'm further on than them. Or we shall find ourselves saying, why those people and not me? I think of the Apostle Peter, there on the beach, in that wonderful resurrection breakfast in John chapter 21. Peter had been speaking with Jesus. Then he looks over his shoulder and sees John, his fellow apostle and worker, just behind him. And he says to Jesus, Lord, what about him? Jesus' reply in verse 32 was, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me. We present ourselves not as workers, but as disciples. We focus ourselves not on many things, but the one thing. We model ourselves not on each other, but on Christ. And let's leave Martha and Mary in their home at Bethany and think of your place. Where do you live? You've got an address? A one-room bed fit? An embassy residence? A company flat? Student hostel? Hospital quarters? Are you thousands of miles from your home and living in somebody else's place at the moment? Some people in London only live under the arches. Is that where you live? Wherever we are, wherever we're found, we can be entertaining Jesus Christ. We can be doing it every day. Have him in there, right with us. Spending time with him, the one who changes lives. It's not time wasted. Our unseen companion, saying, I want to please you. Let me spend time with you. Let it be the privilege of our whole lifetime. And in doing so, we can expect the whole thing to come together. And we will be pleasing.